This is a republic if you can keep it, with former Democratic Party Chairman Mark Brewer and former Republican Party Executive Director Jeff Timmer.
Welcome to a republic if you can keep it. I'm Mark Brewer.
And I'm Jeff Timmer. Polls and petitions top the week's political news, so let's dive in. First, the ongoing battle over fraudulent signatures, which, for now, has doomed 5 of the 10 announced Republican candidates for governor. 4 of those who were disqualified are appealing. 1 has ended his campaign. Mark, you're representing the rule of law in this case and have been very much involved. What's the status of the challenges to the disqualifications? You know, most notably, there's been James Craig and Perry Johnson, but there's also a couple of other candidates who are trying to work their way back on. Do any of these 4 have a chance, snowball's chance of getting back onto the ballot?
Well, thanks, Jeff. I like to think I always represent the rule of law in my lawsuits. No, it's been a busy week. After the board of canvassers tossed 5 of them off last Thursday, the appeal started. 2 were filed on Friday, Perry Johnson and Roger Craig, and then Markey and Brandenburg followed this week. So far, they are 0-3 in the courts. The Court of Appeals said no to Johnson and Markey, and the Court of Claims said no to Craig. They've all now appealed to the Michigan Supreme Court, where the cases are sitting and where they would ultimately end. The opinions were, I think, very well written this week, and the judges represent a wide range of the ideological spectrum in Michigan. So this has not been, by any means a party line fight in the Court of Appeals and in the courts so far, and I hope it will stay that way. We've even had a number of Republicans, most prominently Candace Miller and Ruth Johnson, say, look, these folks hired fraudsters. It's on them, and they shouldn't be on the ballot. It's unfortunate. And Candace Miller went further and said, look, we had some of the candidates with absolutely no resources, and they managed to collect 15,000 ballot signatures, whereas the well-resourced candidates completely flopped at it. So I expect within, maybe even a few hours, Jeff, of our podcast here, we're going to get a Supreme Court decision that I think will resolve this once and for all, and we have to. June 3rd is the deadline to certify all candidates all around the state for the ballot so they can start printing ballots. Those absentee ballots have to be available for folks in just a couple of weeks. And as you know, there's a lot of work involved in preparing ballots. You just can't do it on a dime. So it's headed to a crescendo. And so far, those Republican candidates have not fared well at all.
This has just been an astounding thing to watch. First, the fact that, they had 10 candidates who, I guess if I'm being generous, were C-list quality when it came to the way they were perceived, the resources, their experience, their preparation for the job, how seriously people take their candidacies, and now those 10 are down to 5. There's been some development, some big Tudor Dixon picking up some steam with the DeVos endorsement, now the Right to Life endorsement, which could be very impactful in a Republican primary. It's still, here we are in June. We're two months away from the primary. The field is unclear. No one is polling above single digits. And, we've said this before on this, you can't beat somebody with nobody. But the Republicans seem to be taking that strategy and testing it when it comes to their campaign against Gretchen Whitmer. Hard to take this field seriously. I think we need to be aware that unlike, say, 1998, when Jeffrey Feiger emerged from the Democratic primary and he was discounted as a serious candidate for governor by most of the world, he ended up getting about a third of the vote. John Engler got nearly 2/3 of the vote. Those days are long gone. If you put a ham sandwich Sandwich on the Republican ticket, that ham sandwich is going to start with about 40%, given how polarized we are. So this race is going to be, at least on paper and mathematically, much closer than that race, 24 years ago was. But it could be no less close in reality when it comes to the probability of Gretchen Whitmer losing to one of these people as this race progresses. And so this is that's why this is just so astounding. Just as a student of political history, this is unprecedented. A governor running for reelection with numbers that are, they're solid, but they're not stellar in a national climate that's decidedly against her party right now, and in the state that's against her party right now, but she might win decisively in spite of all that.
Yeah, no, I think the data for her indicates that she is substantially more popular than President Biden, which is good for her. And she's, differentiated herself in that base. But you're right, Jeff, in terms of this field, half of them demonstrated they were C-level candidates when they couldn't even gather petitions. But I also think of the remaining ones now, very extreme positions on a number of issues, which are going to come out. I mean, they are all very extreme on the issue of abortion, and wanting to enforce, if not worse, the criminal felony abortion ban that's on the books in Michigan. Calls for completely unfunding all of our public universities and things like that, which I don't think are going to sit well with the voters once they learn about them. But I agree with you. It's a hard climate for Democrats. The electorate is very polarized. And your pants, as we've talked about the last few weeks, could get 45% of the vote as a Republican candidate in this state.
Sure, yeah. Well, when these candidates are talking about eliminating the general fund from the state budget, when they're talking about eliminating the state income tax, what they're saying is that they're for defunding the police. That's what pays for the police.
And closing prisons.
Closing prisons.
That's right.
They clearly haven't even thought this through. Their policy positions, so much as they are policy positions rather than knee-jerk, words that come out of their mouth, to the extent that they're fully baked policy positions, they haven't even thought through how those policy positions put them on the complete polar opposite of their rhetoric. They're talking about Democrats defunding the police. It's lunacy, because the Republicans, you've got Kevin Rinke talking about zero income tax. And until he can talk about how to replace that revenue, you can have a serious policy debate about what the income tax should be, or should we have an income tax? But if you're going to take that position, you have to recognize that is going to leave a hole in the budget. How do you fill it? How do you pay for the police? And he has clearly no idea, and he has no adult supervision on his campaign that has any idea, or they seem to be lacking the concept that they're supposed to have an idea.
Yeah, it was remarkable, Jeff, listening to the debate today. You'd think they were debating in front of a Republican conservative grassroots MAGA crowd rather than in front of a group of business people in Michigan who are concerned about the quality of life in Michigan because it affects their ability to recruit, retain talent. Yeah, let's unfund all the universities. Let's take away all the road funding. All the things that provide for quality of life here in Michigan that those companies depend on to attract and keep good workers. Again, nobody seemed to have any sense that who they were talking to today. They were just spouting the same old lines. But I want to switch to something in your area of expertise. This week was also filing deadline for so-called statutory initiatives, for proposals to amend or enact new Michigan laws for the voters to vote on in the fall. Wednesday was the filing deadline for people who want to be on the ballot this year. And we had some remarkable non-developments. Jeff, want to tell our listeners about that?
Well, Yeah, after all the chest pounding and gnashing of the teeth that the Republicans have done over the last many months, actually years of you know, the COVID response, their Unlock Michigan 2, which deals with emergency powers and curtailing what the governor can do in response to you know, public health crisis, their so-called Protect MI Vote, which was trying to codify their extreme positions on voter laws, voter suppression is how I would characterize it, and the DeVos-led school funding, kind of a backdoor voucher plan here. None of those made the statutory deadline, which I guess I want to clarify. That sounds like maybe a big deal, but it's kind of also not a big deal with all of these, because that quirk in Michigan's Constitution allows when the citizenry by just getting 340,000 valid signatures presents the legislature with these petitions, the legislature has 40 days, which they can by simple majority adopt these positions. If they don't take action, or if they vote no, then those issues go on to the fall ballot. And so clearly the Republicans leading those efforts aren't concerned with being on this November ballot. Otherwise, this June 1st deadline would have been a big deal. They have said they plan to submit their signatures at some point, anticipating the legislature will take action on that. So assuming they will do that this year, if they still have control of the legislature, they could do that all the way up to lame duck. They could wait until the election results in November to find out if they're going to control the legislature next year. There's some strategic decisions that could go into that. I guess what they signaled today loud and clear was that they're not going to in any way, shape or form look at having any of those issues on this fall's ballot. One thing that was really unique, the fraud that's kind of dominated the Republican gubernatorial field in their petition signatures, that fraud issue has reared its head when it comes to these issue petitions as well. You have Jamie Rowe from Protect MI Vote talking about they're going to continue to collect signatures, get another 100, because they're worried that they have at least 100,000 potentially fraudulent signatures. That admission should kind of taint the entire process. I think that just begs for a top to bottom every signature review, whether it's the Secretary of State's office, the Bureau of Elections, whether it's a third-party review. I would challenge every single one of the signatures and circulators on all of these petitions, because the process and the professional circulator world, it's become so fraudulent and filled with bad actors that I don't think we can trust the veracity of any of these petitions until they're verified independently.
Now, Jeff, you make some great points. Clearly, those four never intended to go on the ballot this year, but they have also now created a problem for themselves, because there was a proposal that did file this week, and there are a couple of proposals that are going to file for constitutional amendments in July. They're going to get priority in terms of processing. And since the way this works is that since they missed the 2022 deadline, arguably they intend to be on the 24 ballot. The Bureau of Elections is under no obligation to look at any of those petitions that missed today's deadline until next year, if then. So, but I think there's going to be a lot of political pressure brought to bear, because you're right. Those proponents of those four proposals want this legislature to adopt them, but they hurt themselves by missing this deadline. On the forgery point that you make, there are 36, at least 36 named forgers who've been referred for criminal prosecution. And, you know, we know they did at least 70,000 gubernatorial signatures. And so I expect that a lot of those same people were circulating for the four that didn't file this week. And yeah, there's going to be a lot of scrutiny. One of the things I do in my practice, I attack petitions when they're filed. I also defend them. But you better believe it, we're going to be on the lookout for those 36 people. And if we see any one of them, all heck's going to break loose about that. So, again, I understand what they're trying to do with their strategy, but they're going to have a lot more problems executing it than I think they do.
Well, I love their, yes, they will certainly scream and stomp and try to create political pressure for the Elections Bureau to process their signatures this year. And, in, you know, they'll claim that Benson is being partisan in using her office for partisan ends if she doesn't. But the only reason they want it done this year is so that while the fix is in, they want to vote. While they've got the votes, they won't say the fact that the only reason they want it processed this year is for their own partisan reasons. So playing their own partisan games. And so, yes, you're right. We're going to see this highly politically charged kabuki dance going on with these petition committees, these ballot question committees for the remainder of the year. And I would not be surprised at all to see the Bureau of Elections wait until next year. I've sat on the canvassers. I've been intimately involved in these petition drives for years, and I just have to say I'm going to go out and buy a case of popcorn at Costco tomorrow and stock up to watch this because it's going to be kind of fun.
Yeah, and the irony here is, of course, is that some of the consultants behind some of these proposals were also charging some of these Republican gubernatorials with petition forgery and fraud. And that now has come back to bite them, that these allegations are out there. They're more than allegations. I will tell you that in the last week, Jeff, and even at the Board of Canvassers, none of the candidates denied forgery, and none of them produced a shred of evidence that any of those 70,000 signatures weren't forged. So, these are not claims anymore. These are not allegations. These were forgeries.
These are facts.
Yeah.
And, facts. You've identified, there's been 36 fraudulent circulators identified. That doesn't mean that the fraud is limited to those 36. There could be potentially more that is exposed once these larger number of petition signatures are turned in by these different by these ballot initiative campaigns that are dealing with an exponentially higher volume of signatures and circulators. And so, I guess history has taught me, experience has taught me to expect that the level of fraud, you just extrapolate that out, that it's not just going to be isolated. It's going to be predominant in these circulators, because they're all using the same people. I wouldn't assume that any of these petition drives by the right are going to have sufficiency of signatures when this is all said and done.
Yeah, no, there are a couple of companies that we suspect that are in the middle of this. So it's not just these circulators, but all these folks. And you're right, Jeff. A couple of these gubernatorial candidates ended up with like 20% of the signatures they turned in being valid, 80% being forgeries. And like I said, the cumulative total is tens of thousands. And it also affected a number of judicial candidates in the state because these circulators are out there making a boatload of money, taking advantage of people with all of this forgery. I've never seen anything like the forgery scandal or the litigation of the last week. I mean, I've done hurry up election litigation, but nothing like we have seen in the last week. And like I said, it looks like it will come to a close in the next few days because it has to.
Yeah, well, they're going to need all that money that they made to pay for criminal defense attorneys and to protect themselves in civil litigation as well. So I imagine that money grab is going to look pretty foolish here for these people.
Quickly. There will be efforts by these candidates, and there should be, to recoup that money. And by the way, I'm available. And those candidates want to sue these circulators to get their money back. Glad to help. In 1970, Michigan voters approved a ban on state aid to non-public schools by a margin of 57% to 43%. In 1978, a proposal was made to set up a voucher system in this state. That was defeated 74 to 26. And in 2000, there was another attempt at vouchers, and that went down in flames as well. Now, a group led by longtime private school advocate and Trump education secretary, Betsy DeVos, is trying again to divert money from public schools to private schools.
We have some new polling on the issue. Pollster Bernie Porn of Epic MRA joins us again this week with those numbers.
Bernie, we now have learned that you've been doing some research into the latest DeVos voucher proposal. I don't know if this is 3.0, 4.0, or where the heck it is, but they keep coming back for more. So would you be willing to share with our listeners what your findings are regarding those proposals?
We tested the idea of the Student Opportunity Scholarship, or it's also called the Education Savings Accounts proposal, but it's defined as the initial test of it was a Student Opportunity Scholarship program for low-income or disabled students funded by contributions encouraged through new state income tax credits. A 48% to 36% plurality initially said they opposed the proposal, with 16% undecided, and 29% said that they oppose it strongly. Now, 93% of Michigan voters know very little or nothing about that proposal. You've got the 48% to 36% on the first cold question saying that they oppose it. And then we tested four messages against the proposal, and all of them were convincing to vote Michigan voters by a low of 60% to a high of 75%. And then we did a revote, and we asked them again, thinking about the arguments against the proposal. Let me ask you again, do you oppose, support, or oppose it? And there you had 64% opposing it after those messages, 42% opposing it strongly. And then later on, we asked, if your legislator voted yes in favor of it, would you be more or less likely to support him? And 64%, solid majority, said that they would be less likely to support him. And before that, we asked, do you want your legislator to vote in favor of it to make it a law? Because under the system right now, as Republicans have done on a number of cases, if they pass enough or get enough petitions, signatures approved, if the Republican-controlled legislature votes for it, it bypasses a potential veto by the governor and becomes law without any input by the voters. Well, Michigan voters were asked, do you want your legislator to vote in favor of it to make it law, or do you want them to vote no, so that you have an opportunity to vote either for it or against it? 92%, which is extremely strong, said that they want their legislator to vote no against the proposal so it is on the ballot. And so I envision an argument with legislators, not only about the less likely numbers, especially in redistricting, where you have so many legislators in new territory, a lot of those that are in marginal competitive districts, I think when they see these numbers or they're presented to them, they're going to be a little nervous about voting in favor of Betsy DeVos and her proposal and not giving voters the opportunity to vote on it up or down. And so the question should be, Betsy and your supporters, why don't you want the voters to have an opportunity to vote for or against this proposal? Because it does take, in the first year, $500 million and a 20% increase every year, up to 5 years, I believe it is, where it increases, and that is money that is siphoned away from public schools. And when we have asked in school districts after school district, do you think that there's too much, too little, or about the right amount of funding? Most school districts, voters say that there's too little funding. And here you have Betsy DeVos and her supporters trying to siphon money away from public schools and give it to private schools. And that is something that is clearly a voucher proposal. The strongest argument, by the way, is that there is not private schools in a lot of the rural areas. And so you're basically taking money and giving it to private schools and students somewhere else, and you're not having that opportunity yourself. And $500 for public school students, what are they going to buy for that? They can't buy into private schools.
Yeah, it sounds like there's a lot of issues to kind of pull out here, Bernie. I mean, the accepted wisdom is, when you start a ballot proposal, you want to start in the 60% range. This thing is 20 points below that,
right,
from the get-go. And it sounds like there's some powerful negatives that could be used against it. And then also this could be now become a factor in legislative races, right? If somebody were to vote for this in the legislature, sounds like, based on your data, this could be used against them in the fall elections. Am I right?
I have never seen a higher number less likely to vote for a candidate based on their vote on an issue than this. In all of my almost four decades of polling, I have never seen a less likely to vote for a for an incumbent than this issue. And so I think that it can become an issue in all the competitive marginal districts, and there's going to be a lot and more under this redistricting plan than there has been in the last two or three decades. And so that is an issue ripe for use in the campaigns. And if, in fact, Betsy DeVos is trying to push legislators to approve of it without a vote of the people, this data would suggest that there's a powerful, powerful message to convey to those state legislators, both in the Senate and in the House, which both will be up, that you might not really want to do that.
I just in full disclosure here, 22, 23 years ago, I worked with the DeVos's on one of the voucher proposals back in 1999 and 2000. And I agree completely with your assessment here that this is a political non-starter, especially in today's climate. I'm not so optimistic, though, that the Republicans running who are serving in the legislature and maybe facing tough races will be as view this as pragmatically. I mean, remember, these are people who oppose universal background checks and red flag laws, even though those are also supported by 90% of the people. These are people who oppose banning or allowing abortion, even in cases of rape and incest, issues that are 80, 90% of the people support. They take that fractional minority side. And unless or until they start seeing this, I don't think they're going to ask the questions in their own internal polling in a way that's going to give them the same kind of information in a way that they'll believe it. They will be more apt to fear Betsy DeVos and the Republican base than they will the reality of what they're facing in November. I just wear my cynical hat most times these days. So that's where I come down on this.
You may very well be right.
Yeah, and with that, though, Bernie, again, we want to thank you for sharing that valuable information, that insight, both, again, your experience as well as the data on what is going to be another hot issue in Michigan during this important election year. So, Bernie, thanks so much. And again, thank you for your generous sponsorship of our podcast.
Thank you kindly. Y'all take care.
Let's take a quick break to hear from our sponsors.
When candidates and government leaders need the facts about their voters, they turn to Practical Political Consulting.
PPC has served political candidates, organizations, campaigns, and businesses for more than 45 years. They work with savvy campaigns to provide the best voter lists available in Michigan, as well as campaign consulting, graphic design, and polling at competitive prices.
Over their storied history, PPC has worked with thousands of campaigns, providing them with, as the New York Times once said, quote, the best lists possible in this competitive state, along with unique and individualized strategy.
They've worked with small campaigns for rural school board, all the way up to occupants of the White House. They are also renowned for their work with ballot initiatives, both for challenges and protections.
Find out more. Go to www.practicalpoliticalconsulting.com or call 517-351-5105.
Show your support for preserving our republic at the A Republic If You Can Keep It merch store. We've got t-shirts and coffee mugs made to order for lovers of our representative democracy. Just go to our website, arepublicpodcast.com, and click on the merch store button. You aren't fully dressed until you have Ben Franklin on your chest. It's the perfect gift for that democracy lover in your life.
Epic MRA is pleased to be a sponsor of this podcast. Epic MRA is a Lansing-based market research and public opinion polling firm whose principals have more than four decades of experience measuring public opinion on federal, state, and local issues, from who's ahead in a race for governor or Congress, to local support for a proposed zoning change.
Our clients include media outlets, school districts, state agencies, local governments, and membership organizations across the state. Whether it's measuring voter opinions about who's up or down in elections, or if ballot proposals or legislation enjoys public support, Epic MRA has been Michigan's premier go-to pollster for 30 years.
Visit www.epicmra.com to learn more.
The remaining Republican gubernatorial candidates were on display this week at the Greater Detroit Chamber's annual Mackinac Island Policy Conference. They had to share the spotlight with a lot of prominent Democrats, including Senators Stabenow and Peters, most of the Michigan's Democrats in the U.S. House, Governor Whitmer, Secretary of State Benson, and Attorney General Dana Nessel. On hand to witness the week was Detroit Free Press State Government and Politics editor Emily Lawler.
Emily started her coverage in Lansing for the Mears News Service in 2011. She moved to MLive, first covering business issues, and then as news leader for the Lansing Bureau. Earlier this year, she moved to the Free Press. And now Emily joins us from somewhere on Mackinac Island to give us her take on the policy conference. Well, Emily, thanks for being with us. Live from the island. We really appreciate that very, very much. And we want to get your hot takes on some of the things that happened at the conference this week. And I'm going to start off by saying, what was the talk on the island? Because I'm intimately involved in this, about all these goings-ons with the Republican gubernatorial candidates. Are there five? Are there 10? What's going on? What are people saying about all that?
Thanks for having me. I don't know if I have hot takes, but I brought some lukewarm ones that at least I guess for you. But yeah, I would say that the predominant sentiment on the island has been sort of operating under the assumption that there are five gubernatorial candidates left. I've not heard a lot of speculation from people who would like to see the ones who sort of missed the ballot get added back on. And I think a lot of that was fueled by the debate invite list, right? The debate was supposed to be the top polling candidates. There were five slots, and then it very quickly morphed into the candidates who were poised to make the ballot. So I think that sort of set the tone at the top, and people were, you know, that debate is a nice sort of cap to the Mackinac experience. People are always looking for that politically. Four candidates made it. Ryan Kelly was the one who made the ballot but declined to come to the debate. So I think that that sort of set the tone on that. I did not hear a lot of speculation that people might get added back on.
Right. So it sounds like the crowd there has moved on and they think this is the field.
You know, honestly, with a what was poised to be a 10-candidate field, you know, it's not like people don't have a lot of options still, right? A 5-candidate field is a big field. So, you know, my sense was not that people were necessarily looking at the candidates who look poised to get left behind at this point. I think people were sort of trying to figure out where they slotted into, you know, the candidates who are left. So, and honestly, I thought they did a good job sort of trying to differentiate themselves at the debate stage, which I'm happy to talk a little bit about if you're interested.
Well, certainly I want to get to that, but I just want to say, is the five that are left, is there any appetite evident for those five candidates aside from their own entourages and some of the, you know, like the DeVos family endorsing Tudor Dixon, et cetera. But is there any sense from the crowd, the business leadership of the state that they care whether there were 10 candidates they could give a shit about and now there's only five candidates they could give a shit about? Or am I misreading the attitude they have toward these five candidates?
You know, on the whole, I think that this conference has trended more toward the left. And I say that because the vaccination or negative COVID test requirement, I think, turned some people off. Of course, we saw that issue become incredibly politicized over the last year and a half, 2 years. And I think that sort of fed into the perception that maybe, you know, first of all, just showing up here for some people was admitting that you either had a vaccine or submitted to a test. And so I don't know if it's fair to compare the crowd at this conference to the crowd at a conference, you know, for example, in 2018 or any other gubernatorial year. But in terms of like grassroots support, you know, you did not see the sort of stuff you saw at, for example, the September conference where I was up here for the Republicans, where, you know, of course, James Craig brought a bunch of supporters with him. There was none of that kind of stuff going on. I did not see any, like, you know, T-shirts, buttons, that kind of stuff. I think I saw Ralph Brandt carrying his own sign at some point. So there was that. But no, I did not see like a giant grassroots swell. But honestly, I'm not sure I would expect to in this crowd. You know, some of the biggest applause moments from the panels that I tuned into were Democrats talking about gun control. And I'm not sure you would have said that about a business conference 5 or 10 years ago.
What was the reception for the governor like? I mean, she gave a speech. So what I'm interested in is, how did the crowd react? Were there particular issues they reacted one way or the other to? What was your sense of all that?
Yeah, you know, so it's kind of funny because in these years, of course, the governor usually gets the a keynote slot. And then, of course, the people running against her shared an hour among themselves. So I think that was sort of, you know, a dynamic going into this. But in general, I would say that the governor's speech was pretty well received. I didn't hear anyone brought to extreme excitement or anything. And honestly, it was a pretty run-of-the-mill speech. It's a lot of things that we've heard before from Governor Whitmer. She's sort of, you know, emphasizing her focus on dinner table issues, as she calls them. And I think that that was, you know, sort of a part of the conference that it was interesting how it stacked up, because it was right ahead of it was literally the event before the Republican debate. But I think she used that whole hour to her advantage pretty well.
Let's talk a little bit about the debate, the four participants. What is the story going to be coming out of the debate? Who stood out? Who said something memorable? Who took a position that you know, might make some news?
Yeah, you know, I thought one of the most revealing questions was actually about the budget, just because, you know, this is a field of people who pride themselves on being newcomers to politics, right? And when it comes to something as intricate as the state budget, you know, you could argue that being a newcomer can be a liability in some respects. And I think we saw that come out in some of their answers. One of the candidates made a comment about eliminating the general fund. And it's like, you know, really, that's a huge discretionary pot of money that probably, you know, perhaps we should keep if we want to keep some of the basic funds. Functions of our
prisons and
right, some like very basic, some very basic functions of state government are funded by that fund. So, you know, so things like that, I just sort of question the level that they've really dug into those issues and whether some of these issues are really a platform plank to them. I thought a really good question from Rick Pluto was they touched on guns and pivoted away from any gun control policy, but toward school hardening measures and mental health. And Rick asked what their mental health plans were, and I just, you know, it was a lot of people talking about root causes. Soldano pretty memorably blamed Whitmer's actions during the pandemic and the lockdowns for some of the mental health problems. But, you know, there wasn't really a lot of talk. It didn't seem like anyone had really spent time making that really a plank of their platform, if that's the way to say it, maybe. And I think that, you know, there were some of those issues that, you know, could have gone in a pretty robust policy direction that just didn't. And maybe that's the point in the race, and I understand that, but I think that's a part of what was interesting for me.
Yeah, well, I mean, you said that you know, the crowd was different than 2018 or any gubernatorial year in the past, but I think those responses from some of these candidates, or from you know, maybe across the board, their lack of knowledge of what the position they're running for seems to be a bigger story than people are making. You know, the fact that they don't have a thought, okay, we've got this, we say this platitude about, you know, mental health and guns. Okay, well, then what's your plan? Well, you know, you get the deer in the headlights. oh, I want to eliminate the general fund and I want to eliminate the state income tax and we're going to make up for it. How? It's kind of like magic beans. And the candidates themselves just seem so different than even 4 years ago. It's hard to believe that the crowd 4 years ago would have looked at any of these four participants and thought, you know, one of them could or should be governor.
You know, I think it's kind of a matter of perspective, right? Like, some people certainly, and I think business leaders included sometimes, put a premium on people who are new to the field. They, you know, feel sort of disenfranchised or under-recognized by an existing field of politicians and think that maybe someone new has something new to bring. And I think that's a valid perspective. We have to recognize them. One other thing I would say is that, you know, just generally, like, what job prepares us for governor? Like, you know, I've been covering politics inside and out for 12 years. I can assure you I would make a terrible governor. I don't know how any of you would fare in the office. But I was talking with Brian Kelly a little bit about that just in an interview up here this weekend. You know, it's a hard job to prepare for, even if you've been in the Senate or something like that. It's really not analogous to that job. It's a very specific job. So I think anybody is going to have a pretty big learning curve. And if you find someone who can surround themselves with smart people who do know the process, I think that's a step in the right direction. And any of these candidates could be that person at this point.
Yeah, I guess, Emily, though, I would say if you're going to run for governor, you probably should read the state constitution and understand that in the state constitution, it says the state has to fund our public universities. You might want to read the budget and understand exactly what you're talking about when you say we should just get rid of it. Yeah, it just seems an appalling level of ignorance. At my observation, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, an appalling.
Oh, please don't. Please don't. I would never say those words.
No, you not. I can. Just an appalling level of ignorance of folks who want to be governor. You think you would do a little bit more studying. I'd like to, if I could, though, and get, again, your sense of what happened. These candidates all have a very extreme position on abortion, right? I think they all seem to say enforce the 31 law, which makes provision of abortion a felony. Some of them, I think, would even go further than that. What was the reaction of the crowd there when that topic came up during the debate?
So I wasn't the actual tent. I was watching from the media room, so I might be a bad gauge on crowd reaction. But I do think that, I mean, we've seen the polling. We've all seen the polling on, a majority of people not being in line with the position probably that most of the candidates were espousing. And there also wasn't a lot of daylight between them on that. One thing I thought was kind of interesting on that point was Ralph Rabant, the pastor who is running, made a point of asking, I think it was the first question too, and a bold move, but he asked all the other candidates if they believe that life began at conception. And, there were some awkward pauses and nobody directly answered his question, which, of course, you're not obligated to answer another candidate's question during a debate. But I did think it was interesting that they didn't really seem interested in going in that direction.
Well, it was interesting because today, Right to Life endorsed Tudor Dixon. So you would think that she, among other people, you know, would make a big deal out of that. And the others would hasten to make sure that there was no distance between themselves and Dixon, but you didn't hear that.
Yeah, no, you didn't hear a lot of that at all. But I think that issue is definitely something that they're all keeping an eye on, and you have to be keeping an eye on if you're on the ballot this fall because of the implications it could have for turnout, especially for Democrats.
So I know we are coming up on our time here. What is your big takeaway? The Mackinac Conference, Memorial Day is now behind us. We're in official Michigan gubernatorial campaign season. What is the sense of folks on the kind of the climate that we're running in? Is it, do people think that this is Gretchen Whitmer's race to lose? Is there a sense that this is a too close to call race? How would you characterize the aura as you leave the conference?
Yeah, I would say that the Republican side is still anybody's game. And I think that makes people think that Whitmer is in a pretty prime position. That said, I think you could argue that she'd be in a better position if there were 10 of them duking it out as opposed to 5 of them duking it out right now. Maybe someone on this call would disagree with me. But in any case, I think that, one thing that the candidates really tried to do was carve out their lanes, right? So you saw Rinke positioning himself as, you know, a more moderate option. Well, caveat, also trying, it seemed like, not to make anybody too mad who might be farther right than him. You know, you saw Tudor Dixon sort of rolling out this this platform on families, and she really seemed to have a focus on talent attraction through that lens and leaned a lot on her family and her experience. You know, you saw Ralph LeBrant being pretty open about the fact that he was sort of a candidate who was running for religious reasons. He's a pastor, that makes sense. And, you know, wanted to bring faith back. He really blamed a lot of societal ills, including during that mental health question, we talked about sort of a lack of God in some of our institutions. And then you saw Garrett Saldano carve this path of really being sort of in touch with the grassroots, right? He kept going back to his experience organizing and talking to everyday people after the lockdowns that were implemented three springs ago. But in any case, I think that each candidate made some headway at this debate and on this island. And differentiating themselves for the field. And I think that is where it's appropriate to be in the race right now. And all of them have to run pretty quickly because, you know, it really seems like this race is coming faster and faster, and that potentially absentee ballots could play a pretty big role, and they go out in a few weeks here.
When it comes to the other politics, the other races, either statewide races or the control of the legislature, was there any sense, any talk about how the top of the ticket, the gubernatorial race, could have impact on the reelection chances for Benson and Nessel and the Democrats' hopes to take over the House or Senate, or conversely, the Republicans' hopes of keeping control of those chambers that they've had for decades?
Yeah, I think that there's a sense that the top three leaders have a pretty good coalition and understanding amongst each other and work pretty well together on the Democratic side. There's a little bit more unpredictability, of course, on the Republican side. But, you know, as far as down ballot, I did talk to, with Representative Lisinski and Senator Ananick today. And, you know, it honestly, the districting throws off my sense of that, just because I'm not as familiar with these new districts, and nobody is, since they're untested, as we were with the old ones, obviously. So legislative, I'd say to be determined, but if there's big changes there, I could definitely see that having some effect on how Michigan politics works generally. And I think that does start at the top of the ticket.
Emily, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate you taking the time and your insights.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Yeah, don't get seasick. Crossing the straits back home.
All right. I'll be careful on the ferry.
Thanks, Emily.
All right. Thank you.
It's been another incredible week in Michigan politics. Our thanks to Bernie Porn of Epic MRA and Emily Lawler of the Detroit Free Press for sharing their insights, their polling numbers, and their observations about all the political goings on this week, highlighted at the Detroit Chamber's Mackinac Island Conference.
And now it's your turn. Please send us your comments and questions by email to arepublicpodcast@gmail.com.
And if the Republic is still standing, we'll be back in a week. I'm Jeff Timmer.
I'm Mark Brewer. Thanks for listening.
You can subscribe to A Republic If You Can Keep It on all major podcast sites. A Republic If You Can Keep It is a production of Michigan Citizens for a Better Tomorrow.